Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Doing very good. Doing awesome.
Good. Well, we've got a fun show this evening. This is a single topic show unless we get into other things, which is kind of how we like to roll. But before we get into our topic, anything interesting going on that bears reporting?
I don't guess so. Looking forward to putting out the top 10 tweets again tomorrow. I've been working on that a little bit today, and that's just a fun gig. I'm glad we're doing that. It gives me an opportunity to hit a lot of things, you know, just one point after another. So
everybody needs to read Stephen's – well, for one thing, everyone should subscribe to the Twitter feed because you get all this stuff in real time as it's happening. But you got to read the top 10 tweets, folks, because then Stephen takes the best of the best, and in addition to his original tweets, you get pictures, you get links, you get additional discussions, and it's this great, like, potpourri of – technological and futuristic and sci-fi and just plain geeky goodness. I can't recommend it enough. And man, you've been cranking them out too.
Yep. I did one earlier this week. So and in those tweets, obviously, with the show, the topic for tonight's show. So we kind of, I guess we're in some ways we're hitting off of that. But this is just a cool subject that we're talking about tonight.
Well, this is fun, and I borrowed quite a few links from one of your top 10 tweets in writing two or three of the blog posts that I did on this subject. So you're not only feeding your own blogging, you're really making life quite a bit easier for me too. Between you tweeting and this Zamanta feature, which just automatically finds pictures for me, you know, all I need now is somebody to actually type the stuff for me, and I'm done. I'm out of the blogging business completely. It's been fully automated and outsourced at this point. So, but no, it's great stuff. I'm looking forward to seeing the next round. Now, I should give an update on our project to get 1,000 people to read The Rational Optimist. I'm very pleased to report that as of tonight, we are up to 50 people on the list. We're trying to get 1,000 people to read The Rational Optimist, and we are now 1/20th of the way there. Either individuals who have been given a copy, agreed to get a copy, are reading it, one way or another, have through the efforts that we've been putting out there, have said, yes, I'm reading The Rational Optimist. So 50 is a great start. We've got to do this same thing 19 more times, and then we'll be at 1,000. So everyone listening, if you've chimed in already that you're reading it, now it's time to take that next step, reach out to a friend, colleague, loved one, family member, complete stranger if you want to make a new friend, and encourage them to read The Rational Optimist. And this is key. This is crucial. Once you've got someone else reading it, tell me about it so I can make sure that gets recorded on our list, because at this point, I think the unreported people who are reading Rational Optimist under our influence is probably, what, 10,000 at this point, would you think?
Why not?
I'm estimating. You know, it's, you know, ballpark. But I we want to get the official 1,000. But you know, I feel like that the influence is occurring. We're just not. We're probably not doing as good a job of recording it right now as we could. So I want everyone who is out there promoting the book, make sure either you go to the Facebook page, Go to Facebook and just do a search for Let's Get 1,000 People to Read The Rational Optimist, or just Rational Optimist will probably bring it right up, or just look for me on Facebook and you'll find it. Also, we'll be putting the link back up on the show notes for this week as we continue to promote it. But I'm feeling pretty excited. We've been doing this for 3 weeks, so if we continue at this rate, we'll be done in a little more than a year, Stephen. It'll right about 60 weeks total if we continue at exactly this rate. Although I think it's going to speed up. Certainly, the people
yeah, it
joining
might snowball.
Well, I think
when
it will.
When
I
you get, you know, when you get people that are they read it and they say, "Hey, this book was awesome," and then they recommend their friends, then it could snowball on us a little bit. I wanted to share with you a note that I wrote, like a marginal note or whatever, as I was reading through the Rational Optimist again, really my second time through. And,
okay.
It's just, you know, it's just basically I was synthesizing an idea that, like, I was distilling an idea that he took several pages to get through. Basically, here it is. When complex trade started, trade with more nodes than any one person could keep track of, we experienced an ancient singularity, the rise of a collective greater than human intelligence that has been the engine. This was the rise of a collective greater than human intelligence that has been the engine that has modernized and civilized humanity ever since. So,
wow.
I see. You know, basically, he spent a good portion of the first part of the book was explaining, you know, really one of the great differences between humans and other animals is that, you know, we have an economy. We trade with one another. And how important that is. Basically, you get greater than human intelligence because the economy acts in ways, it's the old invisible hand again. It acts as a separate intelligence, a collective intelligence. And at any rate, he basically pointed to it as an ancient singularity in that book.
Well, he talks
that's
about.
That kind of blows your mind there.
Well, it's amazing to think about. He talks about how ideas spread and how they interbreed with each other. They have sex with each other, as Matt likes to say, and they produce new ideas. And it's the fact that we have something to exchange with each other that is the driver of the emergence of this greater than human intelligence. And I think he is absolutely right in describing it that way. And it's truly a when you look at it that way, civilization, this entity, is we'll call it an entity, I don't know what else to call it, with greater than human intelligence and with fantastic capability, this ability to completely transform the world. I mean, we talk about the world transformed on this show. We talk about amazing convergence and emergence, and that all occurred when people began to exchange goods with each other, exchange ideas with each other. It's like materials, stuff, and ideas started swapping, incrementally improving as they went, and the very act of exchanging, talk about snowballing, right? It snowballed. The entity became more and more intelligent, more and more capable until we got to where we are, and where we are is just scratching the surface. It's very exciting stuff. Now, related to this, I wanted to tell you, here's a profound thing. Now, am I reading more into this than I should? You tell me, okay? I'm looking at my message queue on Facebook, and my two most recent messages, I got tons of messages about the Rational Optimist. My two most recent messages at the top, I've got one from Christian Henrik, I think it's Nashim. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Christian. He runs the Facebook page for fans of ilookforwardto.com. I don't know if you've spent any time on that site. It's a really fun site. So,
no, I
Christian. Oh, yes, you go to everyone. Please go to ilookforwardto.com. The fun stuff on there. We should link to it more often, and I really need to get it onto the blog roll because they talk about exactly the kind of stuff we talk about on this program. So Christian and I were having this discussion about using his Facebook page also to promote the group, and also I think he's been more interested in the discussion that we're going to have in just a few minutes about Caliza 581G and talking about star travel. And anyway, so that's one person that I've been talking to. Now, right below that, right below Christian Henrik Nashim, I've got a message from someone who said, "Hey, I've read the book too. Please put me on the list. And do you know what that gentleman's name is?
No clue.
His name is Islam Hussein. So I got Christian and Islam.
And Islam.
Okay. I mean, the two messages, one right on top of the other.
Bridges. Yeah, this book builds bridges. It really does.
The rational optimist is bringing the world together, okay? That's all I can tell you. And then some guy named Secular Humanist Jones wrote in and said, no. Just kidding about that part, obviously. But I thought that was kind of, you know, that's kind of cool, I think, you know. That you would meet two people with those names is one thing, but to have them both show up in the queue like that and you become aware of it.
One right after.
Yeah, one right on top of the other. That just, I don't know. It worked for me in a big way. What can I tell you? Okay, well, why don't we leap into our topic tonight? We're going to talk about strange new worlds. We're going to talk about this discovery of Gliese 581G, and I think there is one man above all others who can really set the stage for this discussion. So let's turn it over to him.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
I wondered if you were going to cut it off, and I'm so glad, Stephen, that you just – some things you just got to let them play
off.
Out, you know. Yeah,
yeah.
You can't.
you don't want to
step on Shatner. I think we talked about that earlier.
That's right. You never step on Shatner, but the other thing you don't do is, you know, when the you just don't get enough of that in the movies and then the series that followed. You don't get, you know, you don't get that cheesy 60s vibe that you get with that choir of angelic trekkers or whatever there, you know.
Whatever that was, yeah.
Whatever that is, you don't get enough of that.
Not get enough of that. I was really pleased, actually, when the most recent Star Trek movie ended with that theme, because you've not really heard much of that theme throughout all these years they've been making Star Trek movies. 20 years they've been, what, 20? 30? However, 30 years they've been making these movies. You never really heard that much. I mean, there'd be little snippets of it here and there. It was really nice that the closing credits was that theme, although it was not with the angelic let's go with angelic voice there singing it out. So yeah, that's really nice. Well, I think that does set the stage. I love that speech that Captain Kirk makes there at the beginning, and those are words that have spoken to me throughout my entire life, particularly as a kid when I'm old enough that I can remember when the original Star Trek, the original series episodes aired. I was a very young child at the time, but I remember watching them, and I remember seeing that opening sequence that we just listened to and being just blown away by the idea of exploring strange new worlds, seeking out new life and new civilizations, boldly going where no man has gone before. It's a great set of concepts, and it's a very inspiring set of ideas. And I'm just terribly reminded of it when I start thinking about this discovery of Gliese 581G. Now, Stephen, I know you had tweeted a bit about it, and you've done some follow-up writing about it, but just to set the stage, here's what's going on. There's a star called Gliese 581, and if I'm not mistaken, it's about 20 light years from where we are.
That's right.
Okay, so that's virtually right. Close neighbors. The nearest star is Alpha Centauri system, which is about 4 light years away. So this is in the near neighborhood. This isn't hundreds or thousands of light years away. I mean, it's a long way. Let's not kid ourselves about how far 20 light years is, but relatively close. In galactic terms, it's fairly close to what we are, to where we are. Now, Gliese 581 was discovered in the late 50s, the star was discovered, and it has been the focus of attention for exoplanet discovery for the last few years. There were two planets discovered prior to 581G that looked like they might be candidates for being what we're going to call potentially habitable. That is to say, they're right in this sweet spot orbiting their star that potentially, theoretically, could make it possible for those planets to support liquid water. And that's kind of the litmus test that astronomers use for saying whether a planet is or is not what we're going to call habitable. Now, it's possible, as I wrote about in one of the blog posts I've done about this, it's possible that that's a bad measure. It's possible that the galaxy is just teeming with life and the freezing temperature of water has very little to do with what actually makes for a good habitat. But we happen to know from the one good example we have of a planet that has life on it that liquid water is hugely important for life in this instance. So do we want to assume that we're the oddity, or do we want to assume that we're the norm? We have to assume that that's an important feature. In fact, it's kind of hard to picture life without liquid water, which is not to say that it's not possible, and not to say that it's not out there. But it's a good place to start. If you're looking for life in the universe, a planet that might sustain water seems like as good a place to start as any. So two planets were discovered, planet 581C and 581D, and both of them, in turn, were thought potentially, hey, this could be one. This planet might be in the habitable zone around Gliese 581. Both have subsequently, as we've learned a little more, been placed pretty much outside of that zone. Planet D is still not completely ruled out. Planet C, we say it's too close and it's probably too hot. Planet D, probably too far and probably too cold. That's the most likely case. Kind of hard to say because, you know, a lot of this is being done through mathematical modeling. Obviously, we're not able to take temperature samples of these planets at these great distances. But then along comes Gliese 581G. And here we have a planet right smack in the middle between those other two planets. So 581G actually occupies this space between C and D, right in the heart of the habitable zone, if there is such, of this star.
A couple
of, what's that?
What they call the Goldilocks zone, too hot, not too cold.
There you go. Yeah, it should really be the baby bear, right, because everything he had was just exactly right. It wasn't too soft, not too hard. But, yeah, the Goldilocks zone, that's right. So what do we know about this planet? I thought it was interesting just to make jot down a few notes of things that we can say about this planet. First off, it is very close to its sun, much, much closer than we are to our sun. It's less than 15 million miles away from its sun. Now you think, well, wait a minute. If it's that close, then surely it must be boiling hot on this planet and not in the Goldilocks zone at all. But it turns out that the thing you need to keep in mind is that Gliese 581 is a red dwarf. This is a...
That's correct.
It's a smaller star, and so it's not as hot as our sun. And
but that creates a problem. With all red dwarf stars, the thought is that in order to be in the habitable zone where you can have liquid water, where it's not too hot or too cold, you're going to be tidally locked with the star. In other words, one side of the planet will always face the star, and the other side will always be in the dark. And so basically what you'll have
work through that. Why is it because you're so close, like planet Mercury around our sun? Is that?
Yeah, and that's right. Mercury is tidally locked. The moon is tidally locked to the Earth. It always presents the same side to the Earth. And it's not some sort of weird coincidence with its rotation. It is tidally locked to the Earth because it's so close.
Because of the proximity.
That's the deal. Okay. It's because of the proximity. So anytime you have a planet in a habitable zone of a red dwarf, because it's such a small star, it will be tidally locked. So you will have a habitable zone that'll be always in the twilight, not dark, not not light, and, you know, basically ringing the planet. If you're obviously in the sunlight all the time, it'll be too hot on that planet, and if you're in the dark, it'll be freezing on the other side of the planet. So there'll be a twilight section of the planet that might be just right. So
yeah,
what is a planet like that like? You know, I mean, is the weather going to be all weird and stuff because you don't, you know, you don't have a. Yeah, it's an interesting question to think about what that planet will be like.
There's a lot of speculating that we can do about a planet like this, and it's interesting that you mentioned that that kind of twilight band around the planet between this one side that's always pitch black, darkest night all the time, always,
yeah.
And the other side that's like blazing hot day, eternally. This one narrow strip that might be kind of nice. And it's another Goldilocks, right? It's the just right section within the just right section. It's like we found the perfect orbit, and now we've found the perfect little strip on this planet. So one question is that perfect little strip enough area
to
enough
for,
resource
for life to arise or for it to, you know, or to support life? Yeah,
exactly.
Kind of an interesting question there, isn't
it? It is. Well, to me, just everything about this planet is interesting. It's interesting that it's flanked by planets, one that's a little too far out in the cold side and one that's a little too far on the warm side, just like us with Mars and Venus. And it almost makes me wonder, you know, is this a common thing? I wonder if when we find habitable planets, are they often flanked by one that's a little too far out and one that's a little too close in? Is this like three planets in a row thing something that recurs? There's no good reason to think that it is, but it's just kind of interesting that the first one we find has that feature in common with us.
I would not be surprised if we find out that it's a common thing in solar systems for the rocky planets to be in the inner orbits. And then as you move out, you find the gas giants more often. Now, you know, obviously some of the first exoplanets we've ever found are these gas giants that are like right on top of their stars, just making that star wobble like crazy because you've got like a Jupiter, you know, within a light minute of its star, you know, swinging around, you know, all the time. You talk about a crazy solar system, that would be. But I would think that... the model of rocky planets in the inner system and then the gas giants in the outer system. Well, you know, it certainly makes for an orderly solar system where you know, life could arise more easily. When you've got a gas giant swinging through the inner solar system through the Goldilocks zone, you pretty much got a nightmare there.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
Anyway.
Well, another interesting thing about this planet is we mentioned that it's much closer to its sun. Now, Gliese 581 is about 30% of the size of our sun, so it's a pretty small star compared to our sun. But they're so close, being only about a sixth of the distance that we are to the sun, that red sun on the side where you can see the sun would just be enormous in the sky. And it's interesting to think about what would it look like. Well, imagine this huge red sun, I guess, that never really moves, right? It just sort of
right
tilts a little
sun,
in the sky as you orbit it, maybe if you're on some kind of axial tilt. The year would be a very fast-passing phenomenon. The year lasts only 37 Earth days. We have to measure it in Earth days, of course, because there are no Gliese days to use as the standard for measuring. So you got this huge sun in the sky, never moves, maybe tilts a little every 37 days, and that's your year. It just, everything about this is so different from it's a completely alien, it is a strange new world. And what excites me about it is that back in the day, you know, sometime after I first heard William Shatner give his monologue in inviting us to go explore strange new worlds, I got really interested in astronomy, and I think a lot of us saw Carl Sagan's series Cosmos, and people who've read books by him or by Isaac Asimov. One of the things that these authors did back in this period before we ever discovered any exoplanets was encourage us to think about what these worlds might be like. What might it be like on a planet that's completely different from ours? You know, what color might the sky be? What might you see up in the sky? What if the year was a weird period of time, or the planet never moved, or any of those kinds of things? And it's what really rocks me here, what really excites me about this entire story, is that now here we're talking about an actual place. This is something that was pure speculation in my lifetime, pure speculation really just a few years ago, just a very brief period of time ago. It was something that we could think about, we could speculate about, we could dream about, but we couldn't know anything about. And now here we are actually learning about a planet that's really interesting, like one of these.
Well,
and it's not,
think about
it's not the
way.
Only one. Go ahead.
Well, think about it this way, Phil. In the lifetime of this, you know, this podcast, we went from the only exoplanets there were, you know, when you and I started blogging at the Speculist, the only exoplanets that were known were gas giants.
That's right.
I mean, the first rocky planet, exoplanet, was maybe a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And now this particular rocky planet is only slightly larger than Earth. It's thought to be just slightly larger than Earth. And, you know, its gravity would be apparently very comparable to what, you know, we could walk around on it without too much trouble, is the thought. For the gravity would be very comparable to Earth gravity. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we're really honing in, and I guess that's part of what makes it interesting, because particularly interesting because they're all interesting. I mean, the first time they found another planet out there, that was fascinating. You know, I mean, wow, another planet. You know, that was big news. That was 18 years ago, 1992, when we had confirmation of the first exoplanet actually being found. There were brown dwarfs that were found back in the late 80s, early 90s. There was suspicion of discovery of an exoplanet in 1988, but the confirmation was not until 1992. And I think you're right, probably for the decade that followed that, probably until about 2004, 2005, there were maybe two or three dozen of these that had been discovered. And really, we've hit just the knee of the hockey stick on planetary discovery here within the last few years, and probably 10 years from now, this won't even be viewed as the knee. The knee will be viewed as something that happens probably in 2015 or 2020 or something like that, because we're on the brink of probably discovering thousands of these worlds, thousands of new planets, and our knowledge of the galaxy that surrounds us, the universe that surrounds us, is going to be vastly increased, and it's amazing how fast you get used to an idea. It was big news when they found one, and now we're up to almost 500, I think, at last count, planets outside the solar system. And, you know, people get immune to it pretty fast. I think we've talked about this before, what a huge news story it was when Pluto was discovered back in the 30s. Wow, another planet. You know, this was big, you know, like 6-inch type headlines on the newspapers, planet discovered. And now they can't do that every time a planet's discovered, because they're discovering new planets every day. Literally, every week, new planets are showing up on the map. This one is special because we're really honing in on a planet that we could go stand on, right? I mean, we don't know there's air there. We don't know we could breathe it, but it's the right it's made of the right stuff, and its gravity wouldn't crush us. You know, we'd have to be protected from the elements. We'd have to have atmosphere with us, and assuming that it really is blazingly hot, we'd have to be protected from that, or cold, we'd have to be protected from that. But this is a place we could actually go, and suddenly you're not just imagining an imaginary place; you're imagining a real place, and a place that potentially could have life on it, that could support us if we wanted to go there, or that maybe is already supporting some kind of life of its own. What would that life be like? Well, it's really hard to say, since we don't know too much about the place, but it might be very interesting to see how life would develop on a planet that's half day and half night. Would life tend towards more towards the day side? You would expect it would, because that's where all the energy is coming in. But would there be other life forms that kind of like it over there in the dark on the night? We know that from our own experience on this planet that there are life forms that find their way into the most extreme of environments, into really hot underwater plumes of volcanic ash, and into the deepest trenches of the ocean down where it's completely dark. The pressure is unbelievable, and the thought that anything could be living down there is almost unimaginable. And yet, life finds a way to survive. So what would life be like on a world like Gliese 581G? Well, I want to go find out. I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Exactly. And, you know, and it was remarkable. About the same time we were getting the news about this planet, Gliese, that's a star, actually, isn't it? But this planet, 581G, we got the news, or actually got, basically a hint from Brian Wong over at Next Big Future about the possibility of testing warp drive with a new metamaterial that they're coming up with. And the thought is, if we test it and it turns out we could, it's possible, then, they're saying maybe something like 25% light speed with this type of warp drive. So, anyway, that's pretty slow, and it would take us a long time to get there. 20 light years at 25% of the speed of light, you're talking almost 100 years. But still, I mean, that's pretty cool, though.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if you followed the link. I put a post up with the kind of cryptic title, "Give It Up, Anakin, I Have the High Ground." But that was actually a link back to a post, a second post that Brian wrote about interstellar drives, and he goes into quite a bit of detail about the options. This started as an email exchange between the two of us. After I wrote the first post on Strange New Worlds, I said, "Hey, I saw from Stephen's Twitter feed that you had said this about star drives. I'm going to do a survey about this. Here's the questions I'm asking." And he writes back, and he's like, "Well, there's a lot of different ways we can." And anyone who's ever spoken to Brian or heard him on this show knows that you then get an encyclopedic treatment to how we might find our way into interstellar space. He outlines a number of different ways. This warp drive that he first wrote about, turns out it's more of a thought experiment. It's more of something that would possibly work in the lab, but this exact implementation that they're talking about doing probably wouldn't work to really power a spaceship. They would have to actually put it together differently than the way they're talking about there. But the principle, as a proof of concept, the principle would be sound. But then he talks about fusion propulsion that can get you to about 20% of light speed. He talks about the spaceship they use in the starship they use in Avatar, which works on antimatter. He talks about generating fusion propulsion using anti-hydrogen instead of regular hydrogen, which is kind of an interesting mix between both fusion and matter-antimatter. Of course, Star Trek, right, I believe they use it's a matter-antimatter engine that powers the Star Trek, the Starship Enterprise, if I'm not mistaken. He talks about beam propulsion. He talks about interstellar sails that might get us there, all towards getting us to Kardashev level one. Now, Stephen, are you familiar with the Kardashev scale?
Okay, basically, the Kardashev scale is measuring a civilization based on how much of the available energy in the system they're able to use. Am I correct?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. Level one is basically when you're using all the energy roughly of a planet. And then level two is all the energy of a star. Is that correct? Am I doing it right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, eventually you want to move on and use all the energy in the galaxy, I suppose, would be level three. I'm just speculating. I can't remember off the top of my head if that's right. But one of the objections to any of this talk about star travel is that the amounts of energy required are so massive, so far beyond anything we're capable of producing now, that it's nonsense to talk about it. It's hopelessly unrealistic to talk about doing this. And Brian says, no, we just have to get the staging technology first. We have to put the right the technology in place that's going to allow us to leapfrog to star drive technology. And the technology that's going to allow us to do that is J. Storrs Hall's weather balloon control machine. You remember Josh was on the show, that's probably been a year and a half, 2 years ago, talking about his idea.
Kind of blew my mind a little bit with that. I mean, what he's talking about is pretty cool in that basically you're talking about a system both for controlling the climate of a planet, maybe Earth, if Earth's getting too hot, you could both control the climate and harvest solar power.
Exactly.
Pretty nifty idea.
Yeah, the very useful things, these balloons he's talking about. I mean, this is the guy who came up with the idea of utility fog, and I can't help but feel this is kind of a variation on the theme, but with these balloons, yeah, what you have is you have something introduced into the atmosphere that runs on solar power, and yes, collects solar power, makes that power available for you to do other tasks, and incidentally gives you control over climate, which is a really nice side benefit feature kind of to have from a new technology that you put it in place. But ultimately, Brian has argued that those little balloons, if you spread out enough of them, would give us the capability of harnessing all of the energy available to planet Earth. And with that level of energy available, the kinds of, you know, the scale that you're talking about when you're talking about putting a starship in place is suddenly not so outrageous. It's not so far beyond what's imaginable, but it is a leap that we have to make in terms of our ability to manage great amounts of power, and something's got to get us to that level. Something nanotech, it seems to me, almost certainly is going to get us to that level, or some new technology that perhaps our artificial intelligences help us to come up with. But it's going to be a technological leap to get to that Kardashev level. But once you're at that level, then a lot of these things, anti-hydrogen fusion or antimatter engines become possible. It becomes possible to generate enough initial energy to create the infrastructure that you need to produce these massive amounts of energy. And of course, it will take massive amounts of energy to propel any kind of craft, any kind of large craft to those kinds of speeds. Now, where Brian ends with this, he talks about Project Orion variants. This is something I'd asked him. I said, wouldn't this really be the most straightforward way? We've talked about Orion before. Originally, just an idea kind of using thermonuclear weapons, if I'm not mistaken. It might have been nuclear weapons, but bombs, atom bombs, nuclear weapons to achieve enough thrust, to achieve enough acceleration that you can get to somewhere in the vicinity of 10% of the speed of light. And this was an idea that was thought up back in the 60s, even the 50s maybe?
Yeah, the Orion project, the Saturn by 70.
Yeah.
That's their motto.
So that must have been the 50s when they were cooking that idea up.
Early, yeah.
And eventually, I should say, it was expanded to be an idea not just for exploring the planets, but for pushing on into interstellar space. So here's what Brian closes with. I think this is really interesting. He says, if I got a few million tons into space with an inexpensive launch to orbit system and do not have fusion or antimatter drive, some of that mass can be made into missiles that I can attach to carbon sails in a more modest drive system. I take pieces and arrange for a slingshot around the sun with a close pass of a few solar radii. I can take a solar gravitational energy and solar sail speed up from near the surface of the sun, and with no fancy drive, I have something that is going up to about 13% of the speed of light. So this is like the MacGyver way, okay, of achieving star travel. It would be using just some stuff we have lying around without actually getting to the Kardashev level. And it says, get that thing going up to about that speed and then direct it into something. And he ends with this quote. As Obi-Wan said, give it up, Anakin. I have the high ground. If you have significant space capability, the nuclear bombs do not mean squat. If you're Kardashev 1, you have 25 megatons of power for every second. So he's talking about really making the leap and talking about it in engineering terms. How do we start building up those kinds of speeds? I think it's It's great. I should have mentioned, I didn't start reading early enough. He says, any ship going 25% of the speed of light, turn that baby around and run into something, and 1/16th of the mass is converted into energy. So imagine how much power, how much thrust you're getting out of that. Now, whoever's in the thing that gets hit, obviously there's some cushioning technology.
Yeah, you need an inertial dampener of some sort.
Yeah. There's pieces of this that either I'm not getting or that Brian needs to explain a little better. But the idea that that you get this massive amount of energy created in the process, and this huge burst, and the ability to achieve, 13% light speed is fast. I mean, it would take you 150 years at that speed to get to Gliese 281G, and that's a long time. But relatively speaking, compared to if you were to use like a Saturn V rocket, if it had that kind of range, that would probably take more in the order of 25,000, 50,000 years, something like that. So Brian's getting us into the ballpark, and he's doing it kind of on the cheap, which I think is exciting. And I also think it's really interesting when you read through it. It's kind of our discussion about Spock's chessboard all over again. Just how many different ways we might ultimately do it. And we're kind of in early days here. I think that more ways of moving amongst the stars will present themselves than we're talking about now. But even at the level we're at now, we're talking about an awful lot of potential ways that problem could be solved. Now, you actually mentioned an interesting one in the comments to one of the other posts, the von Neumann probe. Say something about that, Stephen.
Well, the idea is this, that our human bodies are fragile. Our human bodies take a lot to – well, think about it this way. If I was going to build a ship that was going to travel from here to Gliese 581G at 25% of the speed of light, and and I know that basically it's going to be a generational ship. I won't get there. My children won't get there. My grandchildren might live to see it, but it'll probably be my great grandchildren that really get to see it and experience the planet. So, what kind of ship are you going to have to build? I would say you need a space for a minimum 500 people.
Right.
And it would not be
big intergenerational arc. Right.
Yeah. It would be a big spinning cylinder. So you have gravity, and obviously you have to grow food. We're talking a huge, huge, huge ship. That's what you'd have to build to do that. And you talk about lots and lots of fuel to get it up to speed, and then guess what? You're going to have to spend a lot of fuel to slow it down.
That's
once,
right.
Once you get there, too. So, what are we talking about? You're talking a huge expense to get human beings to that place. Now, what if you could just send a computer? You might end up sending something instead of a cylinder that's the size of basically one of the Hawaiian islands. You would send, the cylinder could be the size of a soda pop or a Pepsi can.
Right.
You could send something that size. How much energy does that take to get up to 25%? Well, a lot of the speed of light. Well, a lot. But significantly less than what it would take to send the intergenerational ship, right? So,
and if you have anything like the technology required to get that, I like the image of the cylinder the size of one of the Hawaiian Islands up to that speed, up to 25% of the speed of light. You can definitely get the Pepsi can up to 50%, maybe up to 99% or better speed of light, I would think, with the amount of energy that's available.
Right. All of a sudden you're talking about making a 20 light years, you can make it in 50 years or something. You can get there fast. So you get there a lot faster. You don't have the huge expense energy-wise and everything else of that kind of ship. And then so what happens when the tin can gets there? Well, you've got nanotech. The tin can then builds. Well, for one thing, the tin can is living. You basically have, AIs, maybe uploaded personalities as well. And then it gets there, it builds the infrastructure and that you need, and all of a sudden you have a presence there in this new solar system. That's a von Neumann probe. They're also called self-replicating probes because as soon as you get to the one star system, it builds a new Pepsi can and sends
out.
If
I'm not mistaken, what makes it a von Neumann probe is that self-replicating.
That's right.
Aspect of it. That's what von Neumann was really about. I don't know that he necessarily bought into the idea of exploring the universe this way, but that's okay. We've attached his name to this idea anyway because it works for him. And
he sent out 10 cans in 5 different directions from there, and all of, in a remarkably short period of time, you can explore the galaxy that way. So that's the deal. And I guess a big example of that in science fiction is 2001, A Space Odyssey. The aliens, those monoliths, were von Neumann probes.
That's right.
Alien civilization. No.
Bigger than a Pepsi can, but the same basic idea with obviously highly advanced post-singularity technology. And I think in Engines of Creation, Eric Drexler actually talks about using nanotechnology to create exactly the scenario you just outlined. And if you take information technology and nanotechnology to their logical extremes, if you start thinking in a post-singularity kind of a way, then what that soda can could contain is pretty amazing. It could have, I think you mentioned, artificial intelligence is in there. It could have uploaded human beings in there. So this could be a starship.
Basically,
full of
a civilization that could be in that tin can, and
exactly.
And then once it gets there, it you have a presence in a new solar system. It's pretty cool.
It's a
pretty cool
idea. It's a pretty good way to go, and you can do it relatively on the cheap. You can do that for a lot less, as you said, than sending Hawaiian Island into space, which is a bit more of a challenge. Now, the question then is, why would we ever do it? And so I posted this survey, and I said, if we're ever going to make the leap to the stars, why are we going to go? Now, I've got to say, and I'm talking to everyone listening live and everyone who listens via recording, I'm a little disappointed by the comments discussion on this survey. I know a lot of people have taken the survey because I see it's well over 100 people have taken the survey, but I was kind of hoping we'd get a little discussion going there, and I see there's great discussion going in the chat room right now. So I don't know, Stephen, do you think it's an effective way to get people to leave comments if I scold them? What?
Yeah.
Talk
Come
to
on,
about
guys. Yeah,
Come, maybe whining. Come on, leave a comment. Anyway.
It's Foshi Station.
pick up the power converters. That's right. So I put this survey up, and I said, why go to the stars? And you have to choose one. And my choices that I offered were, we have a desire to explore the galaxy. We have a desire to settle the galaxy. We have proof or a strong suspicion of life on another world. We have proof or a strong suspicion of an extraterrestrial civilization. We have an invitation from an extraterrestrial civilization. We need to escape imminent destruction of the planet or the solar system. And then I put a space for other. Please explain in blog post comments. Quite a few people have chosen other, and again, just saying. And then the final one was, we will never go. And now as of this podcast right now, the winner is Urge to Explore, but Urge to Settle is right up there with it. And the third most popular response is Escape Catastrophe. Those are the three that are kind of rounding out the top three. Then there's some interest in other, some interest in We'll Never Go. Actually, we've had 15 people say both of those. And the ones that seem the least likely to motivate us to ever go to the stars would be discovering an ET civilization or getting an invitation from one of those or just discovering life on another. So I think people generally understand
that. Let me ask you, Phil. Did you take your own survey?
I did.
Okay. So what did you say and why?
I said urge to explore. I actually was kind of torn between urge to explore and discover an invitation from an extraterrestrial civilization. I think that there might be a little bit of confusion between what those mean because I think if we were to discover life on another world, or if we were to discover an extraterrestrial civilization, or if, like in the movie Contact, extraterrestrials were to reach out to us and say, hey, why don't you come explore the galaxy with us, that would radically increase our urge to explore the galaxy. I think we would respond to that in an amazing way, either directly connecting with them or just finding out that they're there. It seems to me if we knew they were there, we would not be able to resist the temptation to go try to interact with them and to be part of the broader galactic community. So I think it's the urge to explore, but I think those other three, the ones that aren't getting as much attention, could all potentially play a role. What was your? Oh, actually, you said what your answer was. You talked about escaping
catastrophe. Yeah, my answer is I agree with Stephen Hawking on this, that we need to get our eggs out of one basket and put them in multiple baskets, and I think that. That means initially we need to have a presence on both the moon and Mars, and then as we're able to, then actually get to other stars. And so, yeah, that's my thought there. But I actually, kind of cheated in the comment and said, well, you're asking the wrong question. Or really, it comes down to a different question, and that's capability. If we're able to do it, we will do it, I think. If we are unable to do it, then of course we can't. We'll never do it. But once we have the ability to do it, it's something you hear sometimes that, well, you know, the reason the answer to the Fermi paradox is that once a civilization reaches a certain level of advancement, they just don't care about going to the stars anymore. They transcend or whatever, and that's why we don't, we have not met alien intelligence yet. Intelligences yet. I think that's bull. I think that any advanced civilization is going to expand in all directions, including through the stars. And so, I think that that's not a good answer to the Fermi paradox. And therefore, once we have the capability to explore the stars, I think we will if we get it. So, anyway, that's my two cents.
Well, I'm not as ready to write off the potentially disturbing negative answer to the Fermi paradox. I think it is, well, it's not really negative, as John Smart described it. If civilizations do reach a certain point and they're going into black holes, or they're building these massive star-sized computers and just kind of slipping out of this galaxy into another level of reality, it's entirely, that's one reason why you would never see anybody out there, for sure, right? if that's what typically happens. I was interested that George Dvorsky had some comments on this, and he actually posted some things that he had written when Gliese 581, I think probably C or D, were discovered a few years ago. And he talks about how the blogosphere has been absolutely gushing these past few days over the news that an Earth-like planet may have been discovered. This planet may boast a moderate climate, blah, blah, blah. He says, not surprisingly, this news has caused a number of pundits to fantasize about jumping into their rocket ships and bidding adios to our polluted, war-torn, and diseased planet. But not so fast, amigos. While many have misguidedly jumped on the bandwagon to the stars, a number of bloggers have gotten it right. And then he talks about how Jaime Casquio notes that by the time we have the technology that would make a 20-light-year trip even remotely plausible, we probably won't be all that interested in living in watery gravity hole anyway. Nope, give us some nice massive gas giants to convert to computronium. Okay, there's one take. Michael Anisimov points out that we have a human hospitable planet right here that we've barely even begun to use. He also argues that even if we did need to leave the Earth, there's a tremendous amount of raw materials for space colonies right next door in the form of carbonaceous asteroids, which make up about 75% of known asteroids. And then Tyler Cowan added, are Earth-like planets so common? That probably means lots more civilization-supporting planets than I'd expected. But where are the alien visitors? As suggested by the Fermi paradox, we must revise our priors along several margins, one of which is the expected duration of an intelligent civilization. So, and then George goes on to explain why it's not – we shouldn't be getting all excited about traveling to the stars, as some of our other transhumanist friends have commented here. And my response to that is, geez, what a bunch of buzzkills, okay?
Get over yourself, guys.
Yeah, lighten up, people. This is an exciting discovery. And to me, it's, let's say there's non-intelligent life on one of these worlds. I'd like to go see that. Let's say we never find any life anywhere. I still think just from a topology standpoint, it would be interesting to travel to these planets. I might like to go by way of the route that that Jemé suggested, and that's not unlike what you were talking about with the von Neumann probes. You know, if we become if we pass the singularity, then we might find that it's a lot easier to use another Star Trek term, kind of beam ourselves around the galaxy, or send ourselves in a much smaller and more compact form. But you know, whatever the order in which these technologies roll out, and however we end up doing it, I think we're going to go. And I think you're right, Stephen. I think it's deeply tied to developing the capability. But I think that's a, I think there's a chicken and egg thing there between the capability and the desire to do it. It's our curiosity. It's our desire to see what else is out there, to see what's around the next corner, that will drive us to create that capability. And I think you're right. It's, once you have that capability, you're not going to not do it. You're definitely going to do it. So I'm open-minded as to whether there might be life out there, open-minded as to whether there might be civilizations out there. But if there are others, that's a reason to go. If there are not others, that's a reason to go, in my opinion. I think that that it's like, well, if there's no one else there, then this is our galaxy, right?
Let's get out there.
What are we doing hanging around here? I mean, I like it here. Michael's got a good point. This is a great planet. We got a great solar system. But come on, this is a we've got a really impressive neighborhood at our disposal, and I think we're going to make use of it, and I think we're going to go see what's there, because that's our nature. That's what we've always done, and I think that's what we'll always do.
Absolutely.
Well, is it time for music, or have I wrapped it up too soon?
Well, I think here's what I want to do with the music tonight. Well, I'm going to do something a little different.
Okay.
First, I'm going to play A Glorious Dawn, Sagan and Hawking. Got to play that for tonight's show. It's appropriate.
It really fits
and,
in. We did Star Trek. We need the Sagan thing. I agree.
Absolutely. Then, because we've done A Glorious Dawn several times, I'm going to give you guys a new piece of music as well, Indestructible by Latho. So two songs tonight, and hope you enjoy them both.
All right, Indestructible by Latho, but before that, we'll have Carl Sagan singing A Glorious Dawn. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Hey, thanks everybody in the chat room. Great chat tonight, everyone listening live and everyone part of the Fast Forward Radio family. Thanks for being part of the program. We'll be back again next week at the regular time, and until then, live to see it.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the I'm
thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way, a more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.
Cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.